My name is Russell Shao. I am the executive director here at GTI. GTI is a 501c3 think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research. Our mission is to enhance the U.S.-Taiwan relationship by contributing to a more informed public discussion about Taiwan here in the United States and around the world. In pursuit of that mission, we undertake several major programs. They include a biweekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, where we feature timely analysis related to Taiwan. We organize regular public seminar series, like the one that you are participating here today. We also organize an annual symposium to be held in September every year, featuring the top experts on Taiwan policy issues, ranging from defense, security, politics, economics, and so stay tuned for updates concerning that. We also offer fellowship opportunities for American researchers as well as Taiwanese researchers interested in pursuing scholarship related to Taiwan. We also started a new cultural program where we also regularly present movies from Taiwan as well as cultural events related to indigenous tribes. We have actually two events coming up this week, one with a presentation this Thursday from a from representatives from an indigenous tribe in Taiwan, as well as on Friday, a Taiwan Culture Day. So if you're not already subscribed to receive all our updates, which are available through our newsletter, please do so on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. While all of GTI's events are timely, I think today, the one today is especially so. The inaugural Taiwan-U.S. Defense Industry Forum was held in Taiwan earlier this month, and the conference brought together many defense contractors from the United States and Taiwan together to discuss opportunities as well as challenges ahead for U.S.-Taiwan defense industrial cooperation. And you'll be hearing about those discussions today from our speakers. Today's event is timely also because today GTI released its occasional report analyzing Taiwan's indigenous defense industry. The report, which is authored by my colleague David Ahn, along with Matt Schrader and Ned Collins Chase, is the first publicly available resource covering Taiwan's indigenous defense industry, and really I think exemplifies the type of substantive research that we are capable of doing here at GTI. We are truly delighted to be co-hosting today's public seminar with the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council. And I really want to thank Rupert and Lotta for partnering with us and putting together this event. Before I turn it over to my good friend Rupert to kick off the panel, allow me to make a brief introduction for him. Rupert has been the president of the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council since 2000, but began working there in 1994. So that's close to a quarter decade, which is to say a very long time. Before that, he worked at the Advanced Telecommunications Corporation and the Center for Security Policy. Rupert is a tireless advocate for strengthening U.S.-Taiwan relations. He has done an outstanding job in leveraging the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council as a strategic partner for its members and empowering American companies in Asia through its value and excellence. He's also the managing director of Taiwan for Bauer Group Asia, a strategic consultancy focused on designing winning strategies for companies. And he's also responsible for Bauer Group Asia's defense and security practice. Rupert sits on the board of the Project 2049 Institute, where I had the pleasure of knowing and working with Rupert. And he sits on the advisory board of a number of other organizations. I would be remiss if I, before turning it over, without also acknowledging the constant support of our co-founders, board of directors, as well as the staff. And so, Rupert, I'll hand the floor over to you.
Thank you, Russell, very much indeed. You read it exactly like I wrote it. I'm quite ambivalent to bias being read in this day and age, but it is truly a great privilege to be with you all today. I look out and hear out into the audience, and candidly, I could pull at least a third of you up onto the podium, and we'd be the richer for it. So hopefully today we're going to have a really dynamic discussion between you and those of us up here on the podium. As Russell noted, Of late, I'm going to make an assumption that all of you have some working understanding of the subject matter that we're going to get into today. One of the areas that the US-Taiwan Business Council and GTI, and it is a privilege, as Russell noted, to cooperate with GTI as we have in the past, and surely will again in the future, is what in fact is going on in Taiwan's defense space at the moment. Primarily, Taiwan's ability to increasingly provide for its own self-defense. That necessity is becoming ever more imperative. As Tsai Ing-wen in her election campaign noted, it is one of her five economic pillars. It's an economic opportunity to develop technologies that can be used for Taiwan's own national security, as well as technologies that may have non-security applications for Taiwan's economic benefit. And as Taiwan's partner in the region, I believe the United States stands to benefit greatly from a Taiwan that is both defensively secure from a national security and defense standpoint and economically secure when its economy is strong and Taiwan has the ability for self-determination. As Russell noted, when was it, Lotta? A couple of weeks ago, we were in Kaohsiung for an inaugural event that the US-Taiwan Business Council is co-hosted with, the acronym is Taiwan DIDA, Taiwan Defense Industry Association. It was extremely well attended, and we had a strong showing from Taiwan industry, not just large companies, you know, AIDC, China Shipbuilding and others, but also highly reflective of the fact that the bulk of Taiwan's economy is in fact small and medium-sized enterprises. How do you get them more involved in Taiwan's defense? How do you get Taiwan's entrepreneurs to think that investing time, effort, and resources in researching and developing critical defense and security technologies could be beneficial both from the perspective of them as citizens of their country, as well as an economic opportunity for them as well. Because the convergence of those two should help create and accelerate the ability for Taiwan to do increasingly more itself. I will never argue that it is in Taiwan's interests to sever the defense relationship between Taiwan and the United States, and I strongly believe that it will, at least as I see it right now, be in the United States' interest to continue to provide material support to Taiwan. Big stuff and little stuff. High-profile stuff and under-the-radar stuff. I do not believe that we should be in the game of predetermining what is or is not acceptable. So anyway, I'm going to stop there and we're going to move over to David. David has spent a considerable amount of the last few months putting together what is an excellent read, and I highly recommend that at some point in time you all devote a wee bit of time and go through the research and analysis that David has put together. As per usual, he has produced an excellent bit of analysis. David is a Fulbright scholar. I got to know him first when he was at State Pole Mill, and we were interacting with him as a defense community on arms sales. I mention that because it's important, I think, for all of you to understand, if you don't already, that David isn't somebody who's sort of coming into this without a nuanced understanding of the arms sales process and security assistance. David has actually been in the trenches for an extended period of time. He is an expert. And we are, as I'm sure Russell is very fortunate to have him at GTI, we're very very fortunate to have him speaking with us today. So, David, over to you. I look forward to your presentation.
Thank you, Rupert. To develop its military capabilities. As its capabilities improve and its intentions toward Taiwan has been made clear, especially with its capabilities of recent days, talking about new amphibious lifts that have cross-strait implications. As those of us in Washington, D.C. who watch China, those of us who have been studying and working East Asia security for years, and those of us who care about the future of Taiwan, we hold our breaths in eager anticipation for U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. But we asked ourselves, the co-authors and I, asked ourselves, what can Taiwan do on its own, independent of the United States? Because if we read the international media, it looks like Taiwan is such a passive recipient of the United States' military support, but we've discovered that that's far from the truth. What does Taiwan still need to rely on the U.S. for, and how can both sides cooperate more in the future? So with that in mind, myself and my co-authors, Matt Schrader, currently editor of China Brief at Jamestown Foundation, previously GTI intern, and also Ned Collins Chase, currently at Johns Hopkins Science as a graduate student, previous GTI intern. We've worked on this issue over several months, and we asked ourselves these questions that we addressed in this 23-page report. What are Taiwan's current and future requirements? Judging from Taiwan's own National Defense Report, the latest one 2017, and its Quadrennial Defense Report review in 2017 as well. Of those future requirements and current requirements, what can Taiwan do on its own, but what does Taiwan need international cooperation to help with? And what is the size and value of Taiwan's defense industry? And how is it composed in terms of the government, Ministry of National Defense, major government-affiliated corporations, and also small and medium-sized enterprises, the zhongxiaoqiye in Chinese. And then finally, in addition to what Taiwan can do on its own, how can the U.S. and Taiwan and Taiwan's other partners work more closely to cooperate in the future? So our methodology was to talk to experts, current and foreign officials on the Taiwan side, on the U.S. side, open source documents like government documents, I mentioned Taiwan's QDR and National Defense Report, and also looked at the Expo, Taiwan Aerospace Defense Technology Expo that happened in August 2017, and happens every year, as well as a peer review process with advisors of GTI and also friends of our think tank, to include Shirley Kahn, formerly Congressional Research Service, John Kasich, Rick Fisher, Ian Easton, 2049, Lada Danielson at the U.S. Taiwan Business Council. So these, throughout the process, to make sure that we're on track with what we're seeing. So let's start. With Taiwan's future requirements, on the left side, it's a little hard to read, but it's clear in the report, if you have it with you, that's already available on the GTI website for you to download. On the left side is Taiwan's 2017 National Defense Report. On the right side is Taiwan's QDR from 2017 as well. So we looked at some columns. The left side is what Taiwan can produce either 100% on its own or with a little bit of cooperation. On the right side of the columns, the yeses are what Taiwan needs international cooperation. So the ones that Taiwan could do mostly, almost completely on its own, are the ones where Taiwan already has a track record of producing these, such as naval vessels and missiles like the Xiangfeng missile program. So on the left, if you're looking at the National Defense Report, what Taiwan could do on its own, almost completely, surface vessels, sea mines, mine laying capabilities, precision strike weapons like missiles, UAVs. And in the QDR, what Taiwan could do almost completely on its own, upgrading naval vessels, missile defense, long-range strike firepower, shore-based mobile missiles. The ones where Taiwan's going to need more international support, especially U.S. cooperation, are the ones that are higher technology, the source components for the United States. Those include the future requirements on the top here on the left side, modern diesel-electric submarines. With each of these, there's a wide range. There could be a crewed version. Even drug cartels create submarines to ship their supply. But for Taiwan facing a high-tech and advanced threat, that's not enough. Taiwan's going to need the most sophisticated and most capable. Therefore, it's going to need international collaboration and components. New utility helicopters is something that Taiwan needs international cooperation. Advanced fighter aircraft with stealth, long range, beyond visual range, electronic surveillance, electronic countermeasures. Then on the right here with the QDR, information, strengthening information, communications, electronic warfare. It's going to take U.S. cooperation. Vertical or short takeoff and landing aircraft with stealth characteristics, explicitly stated in Taiwan's QDR as a future requirement. And submarines, naval vessels. So of these, you can see where we judge Taiwan could do on its own versus requires U.S. cooperation. So as I said, there's some that Taiwan can do with little or no foreign assistance. But Taiwan, we concluded, is capable of fulfilling half, around half of its own future requirements, based on that preceding analysis. But there are some that require collaboration, especially in terms of high-tech equipment. the value of Taiwan's overall defense industry. So when we looked at Taiwan's state-affiliated corporations and the small and medium-sized enterprises, the small companies, we concluded that the value is at $2.3 billion. And that, if you juxtapose that with the defense budget at $10 billion a year, roughly, that would take up about 23% of equivalent of the defense budget. But we're not saying that this is going toward these companies, because like Rupert said, a lot of these technologies are dual use. A lot of the revenues from these companies aren't necessarily coming in because of military sales, but possibly civilian. And it might not be coming in from Taiwan's government, because Taiwan's CSIST and other organizations are actively promoting Taiwan's products at international arms sales, like the Paris Air Show, or a month or two ago in Malaysia at the Kuala Lumpur Air Show. So it's actively trying to sell overseas to gain more profit here. So that's total value. But within that value here, there are the major corporations are the ones, the government-affiliated corporations, take up almost all of that entire market share. National Chongshan Institute for Science and Technologies, NCSIST, takes up about 900 million of that. AIDC, Aerospace Industrial Development Corporation, takes up another 900 million. These are based on their own self-reported official annual reports. And CSBC, renamed Taiwan International Shipbuilding Corporation, takes up about 500 million a year. 900, 900, 500 is about $2.3 billion. And there's a very small amount of that that's small and medium-sized enterprises. And I'll go into that in a moment. So this is going to be the way that the industry is structured contrasts with, say, the United States. Because in Taiwan, it's very centralized. As I explained how the budget, almost all of it goes to these government-affiliated corporations. In the U.S., it's really the opposite picture. In the U.S., the work is pushed down to the lower levels, to the government sets out requirements and then says, companies, come bid. Show me the best that you have, and we choose among the good for what we think is the best and the cheapest. And then these companies, these major companies, like Northrop Grumman or Raytheon or Lockheed Martin, will then go to their subcontractors and say, these are the requirements, surprise us, innovate. You know, we want to have the best product, we want to beat out the competitors. So this is a way that the U.S. government pushes down grassroots innovation. Taiwan, on the other hand, has a centralized system. So it's held, the money is held at the higher levels, at the state-affiliated corporations, and it reaches down these program managers and project managers to these small companies for supplies, for components. But a lot of times these companies are supplying and not knowing what equipment that they're supplying into. So that really contrasts with the U.S. with its bottom-up innovation and Taiwan keeping it, you know, more central, which is the title of this report, is Taiwan's Indigenous Defense Industry Centralized. Abundant resources or abundant suppliers, but it's centralized. So let's take a look at Taiwan's government and also the main corporation. Within Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense, when we looked at it, we judged that the ones that are the organizations within MND that would be most closely tied with Taiwan's indigenous defense industries would be the military agencies such as Army, Navy, Air Force, and the Red Box, as well as the Department on Defense Procurement Office and Armaments Bureau. These are the ones within the organization that would work with Taiwan's corporations, such as AIDC, responsible for aircraft. The Jingguo fighter aircraft here that you see is something that Taiwan developed in conjunction with U.S. companies in the 1980s, with Honeywell for the engine and with General Dynamics for the aircraft, which later became Lockheed Martin. So within AIDC, Aerospace International Development Corporation, you see that there are manufacturing, aero engine, the propulsion, engineering, quality control, technology information, and procurement. These are the ones that we judge are more involved with Taiwan's indigenous defense. National Chongshan Institute for Science and Technology, rather than just do Navy platforms or air platforms, it's the research and development go-to organization of the entire Taiwan military. So they do a broad range of UAVs, electro-optical equipment. They're also involved in the missile programs, such as Shenfeng that you see here. And here with CSIST, the text is small, but the red box shows the sections on aeronautical systems, missile and rocket systems, information communications research division, chemical systems, materials, electronic systems. And now with the third of the large government-affiliated corporations, Taiwan International Shipbuilding Corporation, previously CSBC. So here at the bottom left, at the very bottom, you see Submarine Development Center of CSBC, because they play a key role in Taiwan's new Indigenous Defense Submarine Program. And this photo is from the day that Taiwan's President Tsai signed the MOU to officially begin the program, March 2017, last year. And that's the photo on the cover of our report. Going from the top left, Innovation and Research Center, Department of Materials, Department of Design, Submarine Center I mentioned, Department of Planning, Hull Works, Outfitting Works. These are all included in the report that you printed out. So we looked at the government, we looked at the main government-affiliated corporations, and now let's move on to the small companies. So these are we looked at, according to open source and authoritative sources, there's common talk that there are over 200 small companies that supply into Taiwan's defense, larger corporations. What they do is they provide optics, wires, sensors, communications. Of these 200, we carefully culled out 88 of these based on more available information that they're more legitimate companies with an address, website, product offerings. We stayed away from university laboratories because they're not so dependent on the commercial market. And then we looked at those carefully and we concluded, based off of Taiwan's government's official reports in QDR and National Defense Report, Taiwan's government self-reported that the value of their share is $33 million. So that pales in comparison to the overall $2.3 billion. If you add 33 to $2.3 billion, it just makes it $2.333, right? But let's not minimize the role of the small companies because they are foundational. They are the ones that supply components and high quality steel and wiring. So they play an important role. And they could play, as you can see here, a greater role. They have a potential to play a greater role. But why don't they play a greater role? And the reason that they don't play a greater role right now is because, like I said earlier, Taiwan's defense industry is highly centralized. The money is going to the major corporations, and the security clearances are held up there. As opposed to the US, where I could start a company with Mike or Russell. Some of us have security clearances, we have an idea about how to make certain components better and cheaper than the competition, we could start a company and we'd have security clearance and we can start accessing blueprints and supply. We got to be a subcontractor to prime contractors. That's not really the case in Taiwan because of the security clearance situation. So we looked more carefully at Taiwan's small businesses and we created this database here with the names of the companies on the left. That's just a small excerpt. That's only about 15 companies out of the 88 that we looked at. So our full database is about six times larger than that list. Right there. Just an excerpt with address here, with what they manufacture. We carefully considered each of their capabilities and looked at more information. And also, where would they supply into Air Force, Navy, or Army? We took that and we put it on a heat map. Where are their offices located within Taiwan? And not surprisingly, they're located at the number one top, so they're near Taipei, NCSIST. And then in the middle there, near Taizong, is AIDC. On the south there, in Kaohsiung, is CSBC for ships. And not surprisingly, it's also matches with the population density of Taiwan. But actually, even though this seems unsurprising, it actually is surprising. Because if you compared it with the US heat map, you'll see that the US reflects the decentralized nature of the US market. A lot of US companies are not located in downtown Manhattan where there's a lot of people or on the National Mall. They're located where the military bases are because they're supplying products and services to these bases. And bases are not located in downtown Washington, D.C. Bases are located at China Lake, in the desert in California, Nellis Air Force Base north of Las Vegas in Nevada. Lockheed's corporate headquarters are in Bethesda, Maryland, not in the National Mall, right? So that's going to be a reflection of the centralization of Taiwan's defense industry. So not only do they work together, the small companies with the corporations and the government, to create the submarines that we saw and the Jingbo fighter aircraft, but also assault rifles like this Taiwan-manufactured Type 85. This is wholly Taiwan-manufactured, which includes a Type 86 grenade launcher. And Taiwan's armored personnel vehicle, the Clouded Leopard. developed out of Taiwan's ordnance readiness and So that was an overview of Taiwan's capabilities, and now we turn our directions to what Taiwan could do with international partners such as the United States. When we look at how Taiwan could cooperate, this first came up actually during a Q&A session with Rupert and Lada at the previous U.S.-Taiwan Business Council conference, Taiwan Defense Conference in Princeton, where I was on the panel with Fumei as a moderator back then, and there was a question from the audience about how to cooperate. And at that moment, I had the idea, and now I'm expanding, that is cooperation just Taiwan pays and receives U.S. military equipment, and that's cooperation? Or is cooperation at the higher levels, where you're co-creating new technologies together? And I lay out a spectrum from the most basic, pay and receive the equipment, to what Japan requests for its F-35 manufacturing, FACO, final assembly checkout. Pieces are shipped over in large components, and then just final assembly checkout, Japan has a role. Or at the higher levels, shipping the smaller components for licensed production, still paying the companies for their royalties and research development, but then having the manufacturing assembly lines in Taiwan. Or at the highest level, I would argue, co-creation of new technologies. If Taiwan and the U.S. and other partners want to create new technologies, what types of equipment should they create, and where should they collaborate? At first glance, it seems that Taiwan should collaborate with the U.S. on high-tech equipment, because Taiwan has a highly educated workforce, and it has a very high-tech defense industry, like semiconductors and computer components. So that seems to make sense. But on second thought, Taiwan could also cooperate more on low-tech, because Taiwan has much cheaper labor costs. So examples of low-tech cooperation are when Taiwan's 205 Armory had an oversupply of ammo, and the U.S. needed ammunition to go into the Gulf War in the 1990s, where Taiwan bid and won the contract to supply NATO's standard 5.56 round ammo to U.S. troops in the Middle East. And that same arsenal, 205 arsenal, today supplies to the U.S. civilian market. When you go into gun shops or online, and you see the Wolf brand of ammunition that's coming from Taiwan, the 205 arsenal. And requirements from both, it would make sense if both sides have future requirements and there's an alignment, so that they can work together to achieve the future requirements together. But if they do that, if Taiwan's paying into and working together, then Taiwan should be mindful of recouping what's called non-recurring costs. If Taiwan's working to improve, say, F-16 aircraft, new components and systems integration, and say that could benefit other countries that operate F-16, such as Israel, then when Israel wants to do that same improvement, it doesn't have to spend money to reinvent the wheel that Taiwan already did, nor does Taiwan need to give that for free as a gift to Israel, but that they develop it together with U.S. companies, and Taiwan could, based on contracting, get that money back as part of recouping non-recurring costs. That's more technical detail about how to work together. Where should they collaborate? They should collaborate based on a big reason for collaboration is cost of labor. So the United States, and an engineer in the defense industry, I used to be a senior partner in the defense industry, so I'm familiar, I used to work with the numbers, is that an engineer would make around $100,000 or more, which is good for the D.C. area, but it's considered extremely low for Silicon Valley. And $100,000 salary means that the company is paying overhead, office space, health insurance, matching retirement funds, so a multiplier of maybe 2 or 2.5. So when the employee receives $100,000 salary, the company is paying $200, $250. Break that down hourly, $100,000 a year for an engineer is about $50 an hour, but the company is actually paying maybe double that or more, $100 an hour. An employee works a workday of 8 hours, but say a little longer to make it more round and easier to calculate, 10 hours. So one day, 10 hours times $100 an hour is $1,000 US. 2 days is $2,000 US. Convert that to NT, 1,000 times 30 RMB is 30,000 RMB for 1 day of work. 2 days is 60,000 RMB. And this is very standard, it's very average. I'm not going higher. Among the lawyers and doctors and consultants, this is actually, it's actually 2 or 3 times or 4 times more than this. So we're saying 30,000, 60,000 is an entire month's worth of salary for an educated and experienced engineer in Taiwan, is the equivalent of a person in the US working for 1 or 2 days. So therefore, it makes sense to collaborate in Taiwan because of the labor rates. However, what's holding that back is what we talked about earlier about security clearances and the information security infrastructure. So I'm going to wrap up in the next minute by saying the policy recommendations for Taiwan is to consider broad, expanding roles of small companies, broadening security clearances, consider that, because there's also downsides. Because if you broaden it, then more people have access. What if they leak? What if they pass information to another side, right? Also, infrastructure, top secret, secret level, air-gapped information security infrastructure. And apply lessons learned from fighter aircraft to submarine aircraft. Continue to aggressively seek partnerships and tailor weapons to the needs of Taiwan. For the U.S., it's to stay true to the Taiwan Relations Act, to increase interaction so that both sides can have a better understanding of Taiwan's future defense requirements, and to work together to develop new military equipment and to provide Taiwan with much-needed components to regularize the U.S. arms sales decision process. So to conclude, I've addressed each of the questions that I laid out in the first few slides. We've talked about Taiwan's defense requirements based on its own documents. We talked about what it could do on its own versus what it needs international cooperation based on the level of technology. And we also talked about the size and value of the industry at roughly 2.3 and the role of MND versus the state government affiliate corporations versus the smaller companies, types of international cooperation and levels, and policy recommendations. And I conclude by circling back to the meaning of our title of centralized control of abundant suppliers. It's centralized, and it could be decentralized, and Taiwan should weigh the pros and cons of doing so. There are abundant suppliers, which is good news, because that means there's so many resources that the small companies could work more with these major corporations and the government to provide for Taiwan's defense, and in collaboration with U.S. companies as well, so that they could all work to build a stronger military capability to deter conflict, to prevent that from happening, and therefore ensure a better tomorrow for Taiwan and peace and security for the East Asia region.
Thank you very much, David. I mean, I hope you can all start to grasp just how much work David and his colleagues have put into this. This isn't a 30,000 feet piece. David and his colleagues have got extremely granular in their assessment here. I am struck, David, by how concentrated the defense industry money is around the Chunghwa Institute, AIDC, and China Shipbuilding. I do wonder how willing they will be to release their control over those funds and the interests of the small and medium-sized enterprises, but what would it be without some challenges in the future? We're very fortunate next to have Mike Perry, Senior Vice President of AMS Group, with us. I actually had the privilege of spending some time with Mike out in Taiwan several weeks ago as he joined the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council's delegation to the conference that we then hosted. Mike is extremely experienced and knowledgeable on defense matters globally, not just parochially in respect to Taiwan, but globally. And as an organization, one of the benefits we have is tapping into our membership, and many of the executives that we interact with are of an extremely high caliber and have experience beyond just the parochial interests, obviously, of our organization. This is important because they have that experience can be and should be applied to the challenges that we are confronting with Taiwan as Taiwan endeavors to do new things that are new for Taiwan, but not necessarily for other markets. Mike began his career as a Coast Guard aviator in 1975 and moved to industry as a test equipment design engineer in 1981. Over the course of the next 25 years, Mike has developed and led MRO business initiatives around the world. Mike, over to you.
First, I'd like to thank Rupert and Lada and Russell for the invite to come today and speak to you. I'm going to address this in a little bit different manner. I know that this was a trip to look at the defense industry in Taiwan and how we could work together, but I want to address it from a personal standpoint as a business trip, looking at it from a purely business standpoint, and give you some of my observations and maybe some things that I think that might help in moving forward with the business relationship, not just the defense of the country, if that's all right. The first observation I made was it had been about 18 years since I had last been in Taiwan doing business. And the big difference I saw right away was when I used to go, I was there as a supplier, purely as a supplier. I got paid to bring a product or a service to Taiwan, I did what I was supposed to do and I left. And that was it. It was a transactional relationship, nothing more. It appears now, everywhere we went and all the discussions we had are about long-term partnerships. How do we gain capability from each other to move forward? And there seems to be a huge willingness in everybody that we spoke with, not just the big three, but all of the little guys we met at the conference that we talked to. We talked about long-term partnerships and how we could collaborate to bring the Taiwan economy into the global supply chain. And that's really important, and I'll talk about that in a few more minutes at the end of what I have to say here. But the global supply chain is really the key to the future and to these partnerships. Let's see what other notes I got here. Oh, the capability of the people was astounding. The educational level, you mentioned that earlier. Not in my wildest dreams did I recognize that every room I went into, I was the least educated person in the room. It was amazing to me the level of educational capability that the people we met and the willingness to lean forward and create new things and be proactive in moving forward. It wasn't telling me what to do and I'll see if I can do it. It was, well, why don't we do this and this and this? Hugely different, hugely inspiring and invigorating, quite frankly. Universities, all of the companies seem to be working closely with the universities to make sure that the next generation of young people want to come into the industries that they were supporting. We were at NCSIST, that acronym kills me, I don't know why, but we were a small group amongst, it must have been 100 school kids, right, getting the same tour we were getting. So they got invigorated and excited about going back to school and getting educated and coming to work at that facility. I thought that was amazing, because here you see it once in a while, but not near as much as I saw it there, and it was inspirational. There's a couple of things that stand out as potential challenges. I think one of those was mentioned earlier, and that's the protection of intellectual property. I believe that from a security standpoint, the large companies in Taiwan, they probably have most of the security necessary for us to do business together. But when you drop down to the next level of company, it's not that we don't know that they don't have that same security, we just don't know. And when we were asked several times during the trip by some of those business owners, how do we become aware and how do we get qualified to share your information with you, some of the answers we gave were a little incomplete, quite frankly. Some of the large companies said, well, you go to our website and it explains it all clearly right there. That's not the answer they were looking for. I mean, what everybody's looking for is, can you help me get qualified to be a supplier to you? So I think that that's an action that we as an industry took back. I know I certainly did, because I think that that's important. It's not just pointing to a website and going saying, get it done, but it's actually supporting and helping and make sure that can happen. And I think it can, again, because the desire is there. And I think the capability is there. I think another opportunity, another challenge before we get off, and this one is probably not for this room, but it jumped out at us on our trip when we were meeting with the Ministry of Defense folks, is that it looks like Taiwan's kind of following the India path, again, personal observation, of we want to be able to build everything here in order to do business with you. So they've created an offset program requirement at the highest levels of government, but they put a $5 million number on it. So any contract with the government over $5 million, a U.S. company has to come up with an offset program. That's not going to work. It's that number is way too low. So we had a real robust conversation with them about that, and I think they took what we had to say to heart, and I think there'll be some more discussion about it. But it's barriers to entry like that that we don't want to create for ourselves, right? We want to have an open door. We want to be able to work through things. If there's a requirement for a company to do something additional to a contract that is being placed, let's just talk about it openly and say, hey, we need to be able to do these things, and then we'll just work it into the deal. Let's not do the thing where you can't do business with us unless you give us these things. That's prohibitive, and it doesn't even let the conversation really get started. unmanned systems. Wow, was I impressed. Not necessarily, again, from a military standpoint, but from a commercial standpoint, lots of opportunity to collaborate and work on unmanned systems, especially airborne. Lots of technology, lots of PhDs thinking about it, lots of already capability that's already there, some I hadn't even seen in the U.S., so that was really interesting to me. So I think there's some real opportunity there in the unmanned. Shipbuilding and support. Oh my goodness gracious, I had no idea. We went down to the shipyards and I was literally dumbfounded at the capability and the size and the strength of the industry. I came back, I have a shipbuilding or a ship support group in our company, and I came back and the first thing I said to them is, we got to have a meeting, because there's a huge amount of opportunity there to go not only support, but to bring it into our global marketplace. We already support on a global basis. Why wouldn't I use this great capability to add to our capabilities? So I was excited about that. So I think I want to get back real quick and make sure again that this is a personal observation. I don't want to get in political trouble here. But to me, I think Taiwan's greatest defense against future involvement from other countries is their economic strength. I think if we focus on becoming global partners in an economic sense, for supplies and goods and technology, that is really going to be the deterrent to all of this other stuff we're worried about. Nobody wants to see the other option, and I really believe from what I saw there in my closing more remarks here are, if we can focus on the economic, and we can focus on the technology, and we can focus on all of the brain power that already exists, I think that is an avenue of aggressive thought that will pay benefits to everybody in the future. I really look forward to it. And I'll just say as a quick side note, I was at a leadership meeting this morning at my company, and we've decided to open AMS Taiwan. So we're really excited. And that's just as of this morning. So we're committed to this, and we're excited. So thanks for having me, and welcome to any questions later.
Did you hear that, Russell? We're already being successful. This session is producing companies as we go. Who knows what the end of the session might bring? I'm reaching for my checkbook right now. Mike, thank you. You know, what Mike described is not candidly the kind of stuff that you're going to see as headlines on some of the articles that some of the excellent journalists represented here might write on Taiwan. This is the granular nitty-gritty that is going to require considerable patience over the next few years to ingrain in cooperation what's necessary to build relationships between the US companies, where I really liked what David had done with the different tiers, if you will, for cooperation, to really get into it, to co-develop technologies together. That's going to take a great deal of time, a great deal of trust, a great deal of legal infrastructure and other process to build the sort of trust necessary for the US government to feel comfortable for technologies to be released and developed. And of course, for US companies to feel similarly confident. There is one other area too that perhaps we'll get into a wee bit today. I suspect not, though, but is hugely significant for the US defense industry community. And that is the Industrial Cooperation Program run by the Ministry of Economic Affairs and to some degree the Ministry of National Defense. The requirement that anybody doing business with Taiwan has to reinvest some of the money that Taiwan spends back into Taiwan. It might be the sort of stuff that puts many of you to sleep, but for some of us, it's the sort of stuff that keeps us awake at night. And it will play an important role in just how successful the US and Taiwan are in growing this area. our final sort of discussant we have is Fu Mei. For those of you who know Fu, You know as well as I do that he is one of the most important advocates, analysts, and knower of all things Taiwan securities, the director of the Taiwan Security Analysis Center. Fu is a graduate of USC, Los Angeles, UCLA, excuse me, good lord, with a degree in political science. At least it's not the Ohio State. He also pursued advanced studies in political science at the City University of New York. He's presently the director of the Taiwan Security Analysis Center, a research and consulting outfit with a focus on Taiwan military and security issues. Over to you, Fu.
Thanks very much. Thanks for inviting me. It's going to be a hard act to follow. These excellent presentations with all these insights. But I'll try to pick up on some of the themes that were so eloquently articulated earlier, and try to focus a little bit on some of the opportunities that I see for U.S. industry and Taiwan. Despite the current government policy emphasis on being indigenous, Taiwan's defense industrial base is still heavily dependent on foreign technology, subsystems, components, and technical assistance. And these things could range everything from something as simple as control servos and gyros, like mechanical control, electromechanical control components, electronic components like a TR module for phased array radars, or night vision in image intensification tubes, guidance components, to rocket propellant technology, like how do you bond solid propellants together to make the rocket fly farther or faster, or whatever it is, right? Propulsion systems. Taiwan doesn't make any of almost all the engines that power its platforms are foreign supply. Allow them from the U.S. These include aircraft engines, ship propulsion, land vehicles, even diesel generators, right? So these are things. Things like missile launching systems, combat management systems, like submarine CDS, power management systems for ships, aircraft, ground installations, training subsystems, like on their advanced jet trainer, right? That's foreign supply. That's not Taiwan made. And things like ordnance, guns. Taiwan doesn't make certain types of guns, and that has to be purchased either outright from a foreign supplier and or built under license. So this clearly represents an area that has long been a staple of foreign defense industry, including the U.S. Now, Taiwan sources these items and technologies from non-U.S. suppliers almost as often as they do from the U.S. Then this is mainly because it's either due to cost, export restrictions, or just the relative ease of doing business, right? In certain many instances, U.S. is not the easiest market to do business with when it comes to one or more of these factors. So being able to more effectively identify such opportunities early enough, so let's say we do have a more elaborate export approval process, but if we have the time to get it done the right way, U.S. industry can be just as competitive as, say, the Europeans, or some of the even less undesirable markets that Taiwan has had to resort to from time to time. It could pay dividends for U.S. industry, especially for companies and or divisions whose primary role, certainly either in the U.S. or other international markets, has usually been a supplier of critical components or technology rather than whole systems. In other words, they're usually a subcontractor rather than a prime contractor. So this is clearly an area of enormous opportunity for U.S. Companies, given the new emphasis on indigenous, right? Over the years, Taiwan has been able to acquire pretty much everything it needs to develop a rather broad array of indigenous weapons and capabilities. But it hasn't always been easy. And sometimes components and technologies they can acquire aren't necessarily the most ideal, either in terms of performance or reliability or life cycle cost. But for the most part, it's been workable. So let's say the HF2 missile uses certain components from Europe. That's less desirable, less ideal than a U.S. supplied one, right? But the missile's been in service 25 years. It's worked relatively well. It might be less reliable. It might have less resolution, right? However, but this is something that I think U.S. could help Taiwan with, right? And I understand that everyone needs to respect and comply with export, you know, laws. However, I think U.S. could actually make things a little easier for Taiwan by making the export of components and technologies that are destined for capabilities that would support U.S. interests and strategic objectives in the region less difficult for Taiwan. Let me Google translate that for everyone. If helping Taiwan develop a weapon is going to help U.S. interests in the region, why not make it easier? Isn't that helping ourselves, the U.S., right? And in fact, wouldn't that be easier if you have an additional ally that you know is never going to say yes to China? Having that capability, and you're helping them very subtly, right? Because it could take you a year to get something, an export approval, or it could take you 10 years, right? And in Taiwan, in many instances, it's closer to 10 years than to 1 year. And if ultimately you're going to allow Taiwan to have that component, why not make it a little easier? And this is something I think that certainly is an area that U.S. industry could and should perhaps work with the U.S. government on, perhaps with the help of Congress. Right? So that's the first area that in terms of opportunities. But another area of opportunity that I see is that Taiwan's defense industry, I think you gentlemen had alluded to it, they hold significant technological competencies and enormous manufacturing potential. Taiwan basically, after all, before China, Taiwan used to be the workshop of the world, right? Taiwan pretty much made everything. If you remember Fatal Attraction, everything was made in Taiwan back then, in the 80s, right? But Taiwan's defense product base is often underdeveloped commercially. For example, NCSIS, by the way, that's how the acronym is pronounced. NCSIC, the National Chongqing Institute of Science and Technology. NCSIS is quite capable as a systems developer and integrator, offering a very wide range of reasonably advanced equipment and systems, and many of the products and or solutions that it, however, many of the products and solutions that it advertises or exhibits at major international defense shows are essentially only laboratory-grade prototypes. They're not ready to be, you know, somebody called, and this is a true story, okay, based on actual experience. Let's say a foreign government or representatives of a foreign government. Well, we're not talking about Iran's and North Korea. We're talking about a legit, you know, U.S. you know, approved country goes to CSIC and says, oh, yeah, I really like this UAV, or I really like this missile, or whatever, this training system. I would like to place an order for 50 for delivery by 2021. The CSIC representative is going to look dumbfounded because it's not ready to be commercialized. Let alone 50. They can't even produce three more without considerable help. Right, and overcoming a lot of the startup costs and work and inertia, right? So, significant investments in additional testing and tooling will be required before such products could be put into service production. Okay,
2 minutes.
This is one of the most important reasons why.
2 minutes.
NCSIS has only had very limited track record for export sales so far, despite very successful presence in a number of major international trade shows. So this is actually an area that I see U.S. industry, where U.S. industry could find opportunities to cooperate with Taiwan by jointly commercializing and marketing NCSIS developed product into the international market. And two, using NCSIS product as the basis of submission to meet a U.S. military program requirement. Also, finding better, we touched a little bit on ICP, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Can I be allowed a few more minutes? If I did that?
2 minutes, Foo.
finding ways to make better and more flexible use of ICP credits to overcome the inertia that often frustrate many U.S. companies in order to get Taiwan's military to interested in a system, solution, or capability is, I think, another important area of opportunity. For example, ICP credits could be applied towards providing sample systems to Taiwan for demonstration or trials purposes. Number two, ICP credits could be used, at least in part, to help fund the upgrade of an existing piece of equipment that Taiwan already has, so that Taiwan could conduct evaluation in support of a possible procurement decision. Taiwan should also use this opportunity that Rupert and Micah talked about of revising the ICP regulations to conduct a long overdue review of its ICP policy. Many of the defense officials, as well as industry people that I've talked with over the past decade, feel that while Taiwan has its heart in the right place, ICP in general is in quite a number of instances proven both unnecessary and wasteful. I think the low threshold is definitely one of the problems, but it's not the only one. And in fact, almost all the senior people that I've dealt with over the years would like to see greater focus of ICPs contributing towards the development of technology, equipment, and technology transfers vis-a-vis defense, or at least high technology industries, rather than being used up by projects that have little to do with national defense. I think my time is up.
It is, Foo, but thank you very much indeed. I appreciate that. Well, we have 30-35 minutes to take questions. I would ask that you be judicious when you offer up your name and affiliation, please, and then get quickly to the question. Thank you very much. Joe, let's get started with you.
Thank you. I'm Joe Bosco, following the Defense Department. Those were really excellent presentations. Thank you. I wanted to ask Dave in particular, you mentioned a range of Taiwan companies, medium, large, small, and different disciplines and areas that they cover. What are the legal requirements regarding companies that also do business in China? Are there restrictions on that? And this may get to Foo's question as to export controls. This is obviously a concern in the United States.
So, Joe, you're saying that if there's companies in Taiwan that also do business in China.
Yeah, sure.
So, based on our research, when the U.S. works with these companies and they supply raw components, when Taiwan's small companies supply up, usually whether or not the company does business in China at this point is not so much of a concern because they don't know what they're supplying into. So these small companies at this moment right now, those over 200 SME small companies will supply in. They know that it's going to insist AIDC, CSBC, but they don't know what part of the submarine or what the weapon system actually looks like. So that's where it's more centralized. If it became more decentralized, then there'd be more of a concern of whether or not these Taiwan companies are also operating in China. Because at the moment, if they're supplying optics and wiring to Taiwan's defense companies, Taiwan's defense industry to the major corporations, they don't have the visibility yet to have that affect the fact that they might also have business dealings in China. If Taiwan starts to push down grassroots innovation and to expand the security clearances to these small companies, then that will be a bigger factor. That's something that Taiwan would need to consider. If it were to grant security clearances to these companies, do they operate in China? If they do, very likely they will not receive it, I would think. This is speculation. And for the U.S. to work with these small companies, that would definitely be a factor for export controls. Thank you, Joe.
Joe, you also have some friction within Taiwan politics when you have a DPP government and considerable operational control over the direction that these awards go. I think you're also going to get, for example, with the DPP, heightened concern over companies that have greater exposure to China than those that do not. That is a political reality in Taiwan separate of today's subject matter. Next question. Oh, did anybody else want to say anything?
Oh, no, just something real quick. Staying with the theme of my theme of opportunities for U.S. industry, I think the whole how do we get approved for security clearance and export release, that in and of itself could become an opportunity for certain U.S. industry or U.S. companies, right? A consulting firm, for example, that specializes in walking people through the process. Hell, it could even be the council.
Could be.
See? But it requires certain types of expertise.
Yeah.
Right?
Questions? Sure, Russell.
Thanks, Rupert. David, I have a question for you, and I'm perhaps get a reaction from the other speakers. But in your conclusion, you stated that a strong indigenous defense industry can act as a deterrent, mm-hmm. can deter. Can you explain that? How does a strong indigenous defense industry actually deter what Taiwan's obviously primary threat is?
Sure. Yeah, the big irony with weapon systems is that the best use of weapon systems is to not use those weapon systems because you're deterring an adversary, making it harder for somebody to challenge you to have a better, a brighter future, to maintain Taiwan's self-determination. So that's how, if Taiwan has a stronger military capability in working with especially U.S. partners and strengthening its defense industries, that could be better for Taiwan's entire conventional deterrence posture against the threat that we're seeing. And we're seeing this based on Taiwan's official government reports and the National Defense Report and Taiwan's QDR, as well as the U.S.'s new national security strategy of December 2017, saying, you know, the threat's coming from China. So this is how, by Taiwan having a stronger military, it's actually deterring and then ensuring peace and security in the East Asia region.
Mike.
Thanks for some great presentations. I'm Mike Ponte. I'm the director of the DPP's office here. A lot of conversations we've had talk about the urgency of the midterm threat from China, 3 to 5 years, but in addition to the longer term. I'm wondering, as you were looking at the various defense people in Taiwan and what the programs are, do you see a focus at this point on trying to get a deterrent defense, asymmetrical, all those words that are used, or is it looking further on? I'm not sure. How do you evaluate where the development of Taiwan's indigenous defense is going?
You want to start, Fu?
If you ask my personal opinion, I think the whole asymmetrical idea over the past decade that U.S. has been pushing on Taiwan has at least in part been driven by a desire to deal with the political sensitivity of major arms sales to Taiwan. Right? So I personally may be a little jaded in looking at it a little bit more cynically than perhaps is warranted. However, in many ways, asymmetrical capabilities, let me Google translate that again, less sophisticated capabilities, low-tech solutions or high-tech problems, probably jives a little better with indigenous defense industrial capacity, right? For example, building fast attack missile boats is probably a lot easier than building an Aegis destroyer. It probably requires less foreign technological assistance in some of the categories I had talked about. So I do think it is capable, it's certainly capable of showing shorter-term results, both industrially and in terms of defense capability, certainly something to show for. But I think in longer term, Taiwan's still going to need real toys. Yeah.
David, you want to say anything?
Sure. So, Mike, so where Taiwan's indigenous defense is today. So when looking at its official documents and other evidence, it looks like Taiwan's military development appears to be on track. However, some of the capabilities that Taiwan strives for, such as submarine programs that it lists in its future requirements, are very much a current requirement today. So when Taiwan needs it right now and is spending the money to build it, it's not going to come online until perhaps a decade later. So that is a concern right now, is that Taiwan is working in that direction, has made major gains, as Fu Mei said, in fast attack, small missile boats, the missile programs that we talked about, like Xiongfeng, UAV programs. So it's made a lot of tangible gains already. But a lot of the capabilities that it requires, that it says is future requirements, is something that Taiwan needs as soon as possible.
I'm just going to add my part. I absolutely associate myself with what Fu said to kick off. I think that a decade ago or so, when that the U.S. position really pushed upon Taiwan a strategy, I think that had a great deal to do with the sensitivities over the China relationship at the time. But I do think that where we are right now, it truly needs to be a blend of both. It truly needs to be a blend of what Taiwan needs in the long term, and a recognition on Taiwan's part that there are ways it can spend its money right now that can have an impact right now. Munitions is a perfect example. It should be stockpiling them as hard as it can, reasonably, to ensure that it's not taking away from longer term force modernization efforts. So it's really a blending of the two. And one other thought, when administrations shift, you get shifts as well. That's true here as well as in Taiwan.
Administrations aren't going to
shift. Oh, Mike. So jaded. We'll pick that up at a happy hour.
He's been here too long.
Yeah, Chris, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks so much, Chris Nelson, Nelson Report. Great discussion. Really learned a lot. I'm glad to hear about you opening the office. Because my question, always listening to this, is what are other people doing? What are we doing with our Japanese friends? Are there any discussions with our Vietnamese friends? You know, I'm looking for sort of natural, coalition of concern. You know, you want to try to avoid using the words allies because then you make it a confrontational and God knows we're all for peace, right? But what's going on with other possible partners and customers, research partners, et cetera, that could feed into what we've been talking about here? And I'm sorry, I just don't know, and I thought maybe it would be good to think to talk about for a minute or something. Thanks.
Sure. So with the examples that you gave with Japan and Vietnam, those would seem like logical partnerships because everybody in that area is concerned about China, South China Seas, militarizing its islands, Senkaku Islands, these issues. We don't see as much evidence, especially in the open source, of reports, and we don't see much government reports or news reports of this, partly perhaps because Japan's recently relaxed its constitutional restrictions against that was previously prohibiting it from developing its own arms and expanding the role of its military. Now it's relaxing it over the past two or three years. And Japan is still, still in terms of political regimes, a communist country, so there's a political sensitivity of working together there.
Vietnam
and China is too. So and Vietnam. And in addition, this is the case in political science where we say the evidence that you can't see doesn't mean it's not there. It's the dogs that don't bark. If there's 10 dogs there and they're not barking, it doesn't mean there's no dogs there behind the fence. You just don't hear them. So a lot of cooperation between the U.S. and Taiwan for practical reasons because of concerns from other countries, as well as I'm sure with Japan and Vietnam, is that there could be more cooperation that you cannot see, but therefore we don't have evidence of that in open source.
So Mike?
Without trying to get myself in trouble, excluding Japan, but Malaysia, Philippines, Vietnam, they seem to be in the transactional mode I discussed that Taiwan was in about 18 years ago. I sell them things. I don't have any requirement to do anything else with them. They don't have the capacity to accept anything else I would want to do with them at this point. So I think that they're probably 18 years behind, in my opinion, of where we stand with regard to Taiwan and being able to do things in an economic way. So I guess that's my two cents on it.
Okay, great. Rick.
Yeah, Rick Fisher, IASC. In addition to UAV technology, does the panel see any other areas of modern high technologies that the United States is seeking for next generation systems? Are there any such competencies in Taiwan that you would identify as either areas or even companies that are doing good things that would help the United States get to a next level of capability? Thanks.
I don't have a broader view. Do they have any thoughts before?
So I was really impressed with a company there. You probably all heard of them. They're a gigantic company called Microtrend, right? Their ability to detect computer viruses and things like that and protect against them was pretty impressive. and that's a global issue right now for everybody, right? So there may be an opportunity there. I think certainly they're on the cutting edge of whatever technology exists to do that. Again, not my forte. So I think, and the fact that, like I said, everywhere I went, I was the least educated guy in the room. I gotta believe that they're thinking where if we were specifically, again, UAVs, payloads on UAVs, right? What is it you want to use for? And they gotta have a lot of capability, and they gotta be really small, right? So those two things alone, I think there's some value in that. And if I was looking to start a business in Taiwan, I might be wandering down that path, quite frankly, small and capable electronics.
David?
Sure. So one capability that Taiwan is especially strong in is cybersecurity capabilities and information. And Taiwan has proved itself in conferences such as DEF CON in sending teams for international competitions and routinely every year winning either first place or second place. So cybersecurity is a strong way that Taiwan can cooperate, as well as Taiwan is usually a testing ground for viruses from China, testing it on Taiwan first before releasing it elsewhere, so it has a unique sample. Cyber is one. Hardware across a range of types of software, as I mentioned in the presentation. The first thought was high-tech hardware, but then because of savings and lower labor rates, even low-tech as well. So various aspects of software and a highly educated workforce, software programming as well. So high-tech, low-tech hardware, software. Rick?
David, do you see any indication that the cyber competency is leading to investments in artificial intelligence that could be promising?
I hadn't specifically looked at that question in this research project. In my experience in looking at Taiwan's technologies, I haven't seen much on AI so far. A lot here in the U.S., of course, out of Silicon Valley, a lot out of China, but in Taiwan, I haven't seen as much.
The Taiwan government actually did just launch a major AI initiative. How it will dovetail into what David presented is yet to be noted, but they are very focused on it. I would add one more from my own view, Rick, and that's another area that Taiwan does unquestionably as well, if not better than anybody else in the world, is research, develop, and produce chips, semiconductor chips. Any modern combat system platform for any military requires chips of a high nature and high quality, excuse me. We have in our country the Trusted Foundry Program, and we have integrated manufacturers like Intel, but the United States has a significant requirement to produce high-end chips, and yet we don't have the foundries we need here in the States for that future production. Taiwan is a trusted partner. TSMC, for example, knows how to protect intellectual property. It would make an outstanding trusted foundry partner. If that could be elevated to a strategic narrative between Taipei and DC, I believe that could both be the glue that binds, as well as a tremendous business opportunity for Taiwan. Dennis.
Dennis Halpin. I'm visiting Scott at the U.S. Korea Institute, which will be formally shut down by the end of the month. If anyone wants to know the background, they can do what Mr. Kumar said and Google it. There's a story. I also consult for the Taiwan and South Korean governments on different occasions. But my question for David and the rest of you, right when I left Congress in 2013, there was a lot of concern about infiltration by the Chinese into Taiwan, both the industries and the military. There were some sensational charges going on. Of course, Jesus said, "You who has not sinned should not catch the first stone." I mean, with all the agents now in Washington, Russian, Chinese, Turkish, whatever, maybe the U.S. shouldn't be asking. Maybe Taiwan should be worried about the U.S. government being infiltrated. But my question, to quote from Nixon, do you think, as you're talking about this technology transfer and further development, have the plumbers in Taiwan filled all those leaks now?
I thought Jesus said it was better to beg for forgiveness than ask for permission. Anyway, over to all of you. Does anybody have a...
I had nothing.
I will say this about... I've had some non-classified briefings in Taiwan. One of the most excellent I've participated in is at the National Security Bureau, the NSB. The NSB is really focused on intellectual property theft, and it's no surprise to me now that you've got NSB offices in the science parks. A much broader effort is being taken, I think, to identify how the Chinese are accessing Taiwan technology. In fairness, much like our own pressing concern here, finally, to start grappling with this issue and the enormous damage the Chinese have done to American commercial interests through the theft and of intellectual property and its use to put our businesses out of business.
You know, I would add that the number one issue amongst my large prime contractor partners that I travel with in order to partnership and invent things with Taiwanese partners was the protection of the IP. Number one discussion every day that we talk about.
Do we have any questions over on this side of the room? I'll make sure I'm seeing everybody. Mr. Wu.
This is Wu. Recently graduated from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. And I have a question is that what should the Taiwanese government learn from the issues in the indigenous mine hunting ships that occurred last year, and how can the Taiwanese government avoid such a problem from happening again?
I think that's actually a better happy hour question one in open forum, because this is an issue that runs deep in Taiwan society. It's really not a procurement scandal per se. If you look at it legally, it's more of a financing issue. I think, and this has already been said in the media many times during the incident. I don't think it's a failure of the procurement process or of indigenous defense policy or programs. It's something else. Yeah.
Other questions? Russell.
Yeah. Take the prerogative being from the co-host to ask a second question. But I wanted to pick up on an observation that Mike had made earlier in his presentation, which is, you know, the sort of the disconnect between what defense contractors in Taiwan want versus what some of the big contractors are offering. When you said that, you know, what they want to know was the know-how, how to comply, and then versus, you know, you just look at our website and in the open market pool. But one of the things that stood out to me, and I had the pleasure of attending the Defense Industry Conference in Kaohsiung, that was a fantastic conference, really well done, is that one of the things that the Taiwanese defense contractors felt like they really needed was systems integration. That they had the capabilities in terms of the different individual sectors of developing certain platforms, but they didn't know how to integrate with platforms. How does U.S. companies, defense contractors, then can step in to fill in that void? And I'm not speaking from a non-technical person about this issue. So it's kind of interesting. Okay, so here's a need that they identify. How does the U.S. Defense companies fill that need?
So, again, personal perspective, trust, right? Partnership, long-term vision, making whatever it is you're working on a joint project and believing that it's a joint project. So there's pieces of it the Taiwan partner would do that the U.S. partner does not concern themselves with because they know it's being taken care of, and vice versa. And then at the end of the day, when they start to put it together, it works. So you started with some relatively simple things and you work your way up. It's not an overnight process, but I do believe that's how it works. And once you have a trusted partner, right, then the sky's the limit and all kinds of different opportunities can present themselves.
For systems integration, this Taiwan's has a special struggle with this because of the product of Taiwan's circumstances. If the systems of immigration is a bigger problem, if you're talking about different companies supplying into the same military system or platform, or especially a bigger problem if different countries and different components. In the U.S., if it's all coming from one company that's already a prime contractor for that weapon system, then they've already worked through a lot of systems integration. And that means that when you have propulsion and weapon systems and radars, how do you have them all come to you as command and control to have a full control of that situation and integrate all these components so that they talk to each other? So when there's a big company that's already has already done the work and is already manufacturing and exporting that at large scale, then the cost of system integration is going to be lower. But the product of Taiwan circumstances is that it struggles to gain these systems that are already created by these big companies. So it draws from different components from different companies. And at that point, you have to have a customized system integration solution. And when you have engineers sitting there trying to code the software and make the missiles, talk with the radar, and then make sure you see the full operational picture, and that's just for that one platform or five units as opposed to 500 units, then that's going to be a very big cost on the shoulders of Taiwan. So that's the issue of systems integration. The solution is for the U.S. to be more supportive and to provide Taiwan with platforms that are from one prime contractor, so Taiwan doesn't have to piece that together and then sew it all together into one platform.
And also to just to pick up on what David just said, this is something where U.S. could easily insert itself with a system that could. There's a Chinese saying called, "When you paint the dragon, you touch on the eyes, it brings the dragon to life." Right? Right? In other words, with minimal effort, U.S. could help make the program either a success or less so of a success. Prime example, right? The submarine program. U.S. has been extremely reluctant to help Taiwan in any way, shape, or form, especially on the platform side. Right? All right, that's all understandable. Right? However, there's one thing that the U.S. could do, right? Which is, pick up the whole system integration theme, it's called program management. Taiwan's never built a submarine before. They've over the last 12 years, they managed to find, they scoured the earth, they found suppliers for almost every single piece of equipment. I have this on very, very good authority, right? They found it, right? Even without U.S. help. And now with the marketing licenses on combat systems, they got that too, right? Well, they will have that. However, the challenge of putting all of those, 4 million parts together, it's going to be enormous, right? They have state-of-the-art modeling systems that can show all the footprints, the weight, the power, the cooling, the buoyancy. They can model all that, but they've never put it together before, right? And they don't know whether all of a sudden some country Italy couldn't supply us this anymore. We have to buy it for another place. Right, it weighs the same, right? It draws the same power, but now it has unseen effect on the overall design and construction of the ship. You wouldn't know that unless you built one before, right? Taiwan desperately needs that help, and the U.S. can help them paint that dragon.
Russell, I think you're getting this question really, for me, if I think about my fears about how this all works, how this is going to work, as we spend time and effort in the coming years on this, systems integration is right at the heart. It's where things really narrow. Taiwan's not helping itself, candidly, because what's happening with their decision-making process is that future programs that have any kind of domestic feel to them are going to be run through NCIST. And what's in essence happening is NCIST has been put in a position where money is being put out there, and the first people to be asked if they can do anything is NCIST. Can you do this? And they have an opportunity to say yes or no. And there's usually a pot of money already attached to it. What we're already seeing, of course, is them say, of course I can do that. Well, and then quietly to themselves, we'll work out how to do it later. Again, with complex submarine program, I mean, a highly complex platform that's going to require a great deal of support from all parties. you've got Taiwan leaning forward and saying, yes, we can do this systems integration, when they can't actually do the systems integration. I think then the politics of it really gets stuck into it. Then you have programs that are stuck, in essence, because somebody has to take responsibility for the fact that somebody said, yes, you could do it, and then actually you couldn't. I hope that's clear, but that's a fear I have about the direction that all this is going. And to David's excellent charts, the $2.3 billion, there are only three entities up there. Only three. So the potential for logjam here is extremely real. More questions? Ah, yes, Nadia, please.
Nadia Chow with the Liberty Times. Rupert, could you elaborate a little bit, you know, with the relaxation of the export license to Taiwan? Do you have a vision, you know, what progress can be made this year or the next year? And also with the recent military maneuver we have seen in, you know, around the Taiwan Strait, it seems like first, POA is trying to exhaust Taiwan's defense resources, you know, trying to, if you fly in the sortie and then, you know, monitor what they're doing, it takes money, right? So for Taiwan, the key weapon platform you just mentioned, do we still have time, you know, with all this military presence and, you know, around Taiwan? Do you think for Taiwan, what's the most urgent, you know, need for its defense capability?
Okay. Well, I'm sure my colleagues at up here would have some thoughts on that. Were you asking about the submarine program in the first half of your question? Was that the program that you were asking about specifically?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, my understanding is really with the submarine program now, a great deal of the action in the coming months will really be in Taiwan itself. With the license decision having finally been made on the U.S. side, I'll just leave it at that. I think from the submarine program standpoint, I absolutely believe that it's not too late. If that's what perhaps you were suggesting, you know, part of that question was already asked about, you know, how do you match up a sense of urgency to deal with the moment with a longer term effort to try and shore up Taiwan's defences. I would argue, particularly after a period of neglect, both from Taiwan and the US in the past few years, playing catch up, even in of itself, is going to create a degree of instability, because we're surely going to hear from Beijing about how upset they are. But nevertheless, I believe it's in the US interest to pursue that. In the short term, that can be undertaken both by decisions in Taiwan to do things that are unpleasant, and when I say unpleasant, I mean towards the Chinese, to make decisions, deployment, training, to ensure that the Chinese understand just how unpleasant it would be to try and take Taiwan. And from the US side, I would personally like to see some more overt demonstrations of US support. I have high expectations and hopes for our present administration, and particularly for some of the people that work for the president. But as yet, mostly, we have not seen any overt demonstrations of support from the Trump administration since this heightened period of tension. And actions by the Chinese. And I hope that changes soon, candidly. I genuinely do. I think it's destabilizing.
So for Taiwan's most urgent requirements, I think Taiwan's already done a good job with some of the key pieces of military equipment that is critical. Fumei talked about fast missile boats. Taiwan's been very assertive on manufacturing those. And also against the aerial missile threat. Taiwan possesses Patriot missiles and has also developed its own interceptor missile systems. Against amphibious invasion, sea mines, Taiwan's been very active in each of these areas. And the ways that Taiwan could improve in the future are the ones that we saw earlier on the slide with Taiwan's own QDR and National Defense Report, listing out the various requirements such as submarine and UAV. Submarine especially as an underwater, hard-to-detect deterrent against blockade and embargo.
David, a follow-up. In your report, you mentioned Australia could be a potential partner. Could you elaborate on what Australia can do to be Taiwan's partner?
Sure. Australia is a U.S. ally under, mutual defense treaty ally under ANZUS. So U.S. already works closely with Taiwan. The U.S. works with Australia. There's a lot of interoperability, potential interoperability there. Australia is considered NATO plus four by the U.S. And Australia has also operates diesel electric submarines. So there's a lot of potential there as well. Whereas we know the U.S. submarines all nuclear propulsion, but Australia and Japan are diesel electric, which is in the same type of propulsion that Taiwan's looking for. But there's a broad range. Australia operates Super Hornet, F-18, EF. Taiwan doesn't. It operates F-16s. However, there's a lot of mutual reliance on U.S. technology.
I had Australia mainly in mind. My question, actually.
Okay.
I thought I would name Japan, Vietnam,
because it's closer.
Nadia, I actually would point you to a report USTVC did with Project 2049 several years ago about arms sales. And I think it's really stood the test of time. One of the real walkaways is when we talk about the development of domestic defense industry, and we talk about the bleating that comes from Beijing when the U.S. undertakes these actions, it's typically the headline that they respond to. It is the notification to Congress that political moment in the transaction. However, there's a tremendous amount of commercial engagement that takes place that isn't in the headline, and candidly results in no response from the Chinese because it's not in their face, it's not in the forefront, it's not reported on, and as a consequence the Chinese don't feel compelled to respond. And I think that in part way, from a positive standpoint, lends credence to the notion that there's so much more we can do without causing undue friction. Not that I mind so much about that. I actually think it's quite healthy from time to time. But nevertheless, there is a tremendous amount we can do without it being in the headlines.
Just one quick observation about the short-term versus whatever, long-term. There's an element of irony in all this, or disjuncture, in that the so-called asymmetrical capabilities, while they may be effective, I actually have a Louis Cha analogy in mind, but I'll talk about that, you know, over a drinking session or something. But asymmetrical capabilities, while they may be good, effective at deterring or countering or defending against certain types of invasion scenarios, principally the invasion scenarios, they're probably not as useful, or not very useful at all, with the current intimidation tactics that China is pulling, right? Mobile missile batteries, they're not going to do anything with, you know, H-6s flying around 300 kilometers, you know, east of Taiwan, right? So they actually, it further actually reinforces the case that Taiwan needs the longer term stuff, right? You need aircraft that has long legs that can go out there and do supersonic intercepts 200 nautical miles from the Taiwan's coastline. Right, 80 kilometers east of the ADIZ. Right, that's not something that a so-called asymmetrical, or at least for the near foreseeable future, indigenous capacity are going to be able to provide.
We have time for one more question, Chris.
Thanks. Thanks, Chris. I also appreciate the indulgence for question number two. You made a really important point about Trump administration has not done a high-profile feel-good thing yet. It seems to me there's something coming up that might meet the definition of what you were warning about, that is the AIT opening. You know, who at what level do they send? If you had your preference or your druthers, would you put that as more of a show business thing while we're doing things that actually would make a more substantial difference? Or would you be willing to advocate as high level as possible, and if the Chinese get really mad, then do that?
Chris, if it was my decision, first and foremost, I don't think it's either or. I think sending a high level official to the AIT opening goes hand in hand with a broad array of demonstrations by the U.S., both rhetorical as well as substantive, to demonstrate our overt support for Taiwan. In the absence of those actions, I believe it's destabilizing. I believe we send the wrong message to the Chinese. As to the AIT opening, it would be terrific to see the Trump administration, whether in this opportunity or in future opportunities, to get back to what the Clinton administration were last ones to do it consistently, send economic cabinet officers to Taiwan. It is an own goal. We are negotiating with ourselves when we don't do that. It's a point of considerable frustration. And, of course, it telegraphs to the Chinese that this is an important moment for us in our relationship with Taiwan. I want to thank you all very much indeed for joining us. Russell, thank you very much indeed for the opportunity to partner with you. It really is a privilege. You're doing tremendous work with GTI. I really would ask all of you to continue to support GTI and USTBC in our work, not just together in sessions like this, but individually as organizations, and continue to support the US-Taiwan relationship. Thank you all very much for coming today.